We've been taking some time over the previous few weeks to think about what it means to have confidence in God and looking at a number of different ways in which, a number of different areas really in which we're to have that confidence, that assurance from God, and in the ways in which we then are called to respond in confidence to God. Our passage this morning might just be a little diversion in one sense, in that we could just keep hearing that word circumcision and just become very distracted by that as an issue. But I honestly felt that this was very much at the heart of what it means, and this passage particularly helpful in terms of understanding a much broader issue that actually, although the issue is kind of cemented around circumcision in this particular passage, that actually there's a broader truth here, a principle that is spoken to the church at Galatia that I'm hoping very much will help us this morning. Our passage this morning begins with this great big statement, which is a wonderful statement, but the reality is that it probably more realistically connects to the end of the previous chapter rather than the beginning of this next chapter. It says, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery." But actually, my sense is that probably, although this could very much be a pivotal verse, that this is probably very much connected to the previous discussion at the end of chapter 4. You don't need to know what the discussion is at the end of chapter 4 other than me telling you that it's all about Hagar and Sarah and that you're to live like somebody born of a free woman rather than of a slave woman. That there's a certain freedom that goes alongside that. It's sort of as simple as that. I'm sure there's plenty more that I could say about it had I prepared that sermon this morning, but I haven't, so therefore I shan't. But it's very much about that. It's about that sense that actually we're to live as those people who have been set free, that you were spiritually born, if you like, into that place of freedom because you were born and are part of the family of Abraham, who was Sarah's husband, and you were born of that line, that Jesus Christ himself is part of that expression of freedom. So therefore this begins in that place of freedom. It's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then and do not let yourselves be burdened again by the yoke of slavery. But it's also about what comes next, I guess, in that this pivotal statement leads us to that place where we understand the concept of freedom. And actually an awful lot of what we will talk about this morning is freedom. It's just that Paul then focuses his eyes in, as he already has done in the book of Galatians, onto this particular issue, but around this issue of circumcision. The problem with the church in Galatia is that there's a group of people who we would probably call heretics. Now, I was thinking about what it meant to be a heretic this week, wondering if I had ever been one. As far as I know, I haven't. But there was just that kind of thought in my mind as to what it actually means to be a heretic. A heretic is probably just somebody who has an unorthodox thought and believes that unorthodox thought to be truth in some fashion. And I was thinking, I think in my head, the concept of heresy and somebody being a heretic is one that I've always, that person must be evil. I don't know whether you have that thought in your mind, but that somebody who's a heretic has definitely got bad intentions at their heart. I'm not sure that's true. I think there is probably been many a heresy that has developed into the life of the church where the person's intentions was probably pretty good. And actually, I kind of sense that around this issue, that I wonder whether actually that this great big heresy that Paul's got very angry about, I'm not objecting to Paul's anger at this point, but there's this heresy within the church, and there's this group of people that are, well, perhaps, and it's very hard to know in these things, perhaps they're actually just trying to encourage people to walk more closely with God. Now, they're doing it in the wrong way, and we'll explore a little bit as to why they're doing it in the wrong way, but actually, perhaps that's their heart's intention, that actually at the heart of this is a group of people, and they're a group of best-intentioned people who've just deviated the wrong way. They've just kind of misunderstood the message of Jesus. But do you know what? It's a minefield, isn't it? Our own thought, our own faith, our own spirituality actually is full of those kinds of places, isn't it? that actually it's very easy to make common mistakes in terms of our faith and our standing before God. But actually, again, what Paul does here in writing to the church at Galatia is he gives us the solid ground upon which we must build ourselves. He gives us the basic truth, the profound truth, so that we might build out of that place. And I think that's personally really helpful. And then he says what we're to do with that. So that's our kind of journey of exploration this morning. We're going to look at actually what simple, profound truth that Paul is bringing out around this particular issue of circumcision. But then we're going to see what we're supposed to do out of that. And it's all around this concept, really, of freedom. Though the title of our sermon this morning is Confidence to Serve. You will see that that has its own response later. So Paul articulates most clearly around this issue of circumcision. Some of you here this morning may feel that that's not necessarily an issue for you, for all sorts of reasons. This is talking to the males within the particular church context. I'm quite sure of that, though we understand, of course, that there is the issue of female circumcision out in the world. That's a huge problem in lots of areas of the world. But let's focus down and understand that this is very much an issue of male circumcision. I'm going to try not to say that word too often, but it's necessary at different points. The issue is then distilled down to this, that this group of rebels, heretics, trying to understand what it means to be a heretic, are challenging the congregation to conform and covenant in the old way of doing things. Now, first of all, I've got great sympathy for this because I think it's part of the human inclination, isn't it? That actually, if we're trying to think about something, that we remember a point in our past where it felt like we were walking close with the Lord in some fashion, and we defer to that experience rather than perhaps the present reality. You maybe don't recognize that, but as a pastor with his eye on the church, I can assure you that that's an issue for the human nature, and particularly those part of the church, that actually we remember those good old choruses from the 1980s, and we say, well, that was good, because at the time that was good and great, and we experienced the presence of the Lord in those places, therefore, why don't we sing all of those choruses? Well, there's nothing wrong with singing all of those choruses. It's just that that time was that time, and that experience was that experience, and the Lord is still working in new and different ways. It's the same for those people who would say, well, there were some great hymns in the 1870s. Weren't there some great hymns in the 1870s? And I'm sure those people from the 1870s, I'm not sure if any of you are from the 1870s are here this morning. I'm trying not to catch anybody's eye in order to insult them. That actually they must have felt the same, that actually that there was a point in that they said, well, these are the hymns, these are the ones, and it has to all be done in the day, it has to be done in that way, because that was the way that it always felt right. When we were singing those hymns, that was, but actually again, we would happily say, most of us, I think here this morning, that actually time has moved on, that things have changed, that we're now in the position where actually things are as they are now, that we do things in the way that we do them, and our hope and our prayer is that we experience and understand God in this context, in this way, that in that way culture within the church changes, and the hope is that that's a culture that looks towards Christ rather than walks away from him. That actually that's our ambition here, that somehow we're seeking Christ at this time and for now. Whatever that means, that actually we have that ambition to be somehow relevant to each other, that we understand the language that we're talking, rather than just pining back to the way things used to be. I am personally glad that we don't have pews here this morning, but I know the temptation of some of you would be to, well, they were nice, weren't they? I can catch up a few significant eyes there. Those of you upstairs are experiencing things as they used to be. But there is that tension. Isn't there that inclination of the human heart? I just want to recreate those things that I knew and understood from the past. And effectively, I think that's where this heresy to the church at Galatia comes from. Because they're saying this, that in the good old days, it used to be that as an outward sign of covenant, that the boys would be snipped. And that was a sign of God doing something, that was a sign of covenant and promise and hope, and that actually it was a sign of intimacy with the Lord, that here was a sign of goodness, that actually the participation in this was just something that was great to do because it drew us close to the Lord. Therefore, surely it's the case, they said. Surely it's the case that when in this process of all of these other people coming to faith, these Gentiles coming to faith, these people who hadn't grown up in that Hebrew society, in that Jewish society, that they were discovering Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the promised one of the old covenant. Well, surely it makes sense that they ought to be circumcised as a sign of that new, so that they're part of it. Because we've had all this done and we're part of it. We've seen this old promise. We understand. Therefore, surely they must all do that. It's like saying, in order to appreciate disco music, I have to dress up in flares and spangles and all of those kind of things. I can appreciate disco music beyond that. But it's that thought, isn't it, that the only way that they could draw close was that they needed to do that to themselves as a sign of their intimacy with God, as that outward sign of that old covenant. But you see the issue that Paul has with this, and he explains it so very well to the church at Galatia, and I hope that it will become clear to you too. He says, look, if you're going to do this, that outward sign of circumcision is one that binds you to the law. The law is the old covenant, the old way of doing things, the things how they used to be with Moses, that discount or don't get far enough towards the things that Jesus have done. He says, if you're willing to be circumcised, if you're doing that as an act of devotion, actually what you're doing is you're binding yourself to the law. You're saying that is my place of intimacy and covenant and hope. And what he says is, very clearly, if you bind yourself to the old way of doing things, you're going to die and live according to those old things. And what you're going to do without is the redeeming power, the saving power of Jesus Christ, who out of his incredible mercy and grace has shown you a new way. By all means, get circumcised, he says, but you're going to be committing yourself to something that will lead you to a place of death rather than to a place of life. So he says, in that way, choose differently. You don't need to be circumcised in order to know Jesus Christ, to experience the grace that he has for you. You don't need to. And then he says the most brilliant thing, I think, because Paul understands the human nature, I presume, as well as he does, because he experiences these things. He knows the human thought process. And he says, that doesn't mean that your status with regard to circumcision is something to be held over somebody, or that actually it doesn't matter then whether you're circumcised or whether you're not. It's still not something to say, na, 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 I'm better than you. That actually neither circumcision or uncircumcision is anything to be held, that it's worthless. That actually the only thing that matters is your faith in God. That's the only thing that he has said is the thing that counts. So here's the choice, Paul says. That actually you choose to live for Jesus Christ. And that comes as an expression of faith from a place of grace in your heart. You can choose that. And that in itself is a place of freedom for you. But if you choose to put any other criteria, any other work, any other thing, any other legal stipulation in the way, it's a path that will lead to death. And I think this is one of the places where the church at large gets things wrong consistently. That actually too often we say, here is the way that you must walk in order to have faith. Here is the things that you must do in order to walk with us. Here is the criteria that we expect in order for you to come walk forwards. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. It undermines the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel of Jesus Christ says it's all about faith. So that hopefully distills for you some of the argument that Paul is making here about this issue of circumcision. Actually, he goes further to say, if it was all about circumcision, why on earth am I being persecuted? Why am I willing to carry on with that persecution? Because the cross wouldn't be offensive to that society if it was still that. It wouldn't be. Why am I still being persecuted, he said. Why am I willing to be persecuted if this were not the case? We might say here that the battle is about what it means to be justified, or as we know in theological terms, justification. Justification is one of those kind of technical words in Scripture, and one of those that we kind of gloss over a little bit, but I'm hoping that we've begun to understand it here, because I know that I've said it fairly regularly, begun to teach about it fairly regularly, but as I've said before, it's about this legal term that Paul uses, and he uses it in this particular place to describe what it means to live in freedom. Our sin condemns us in lots of ways, doesn't it? Every sin that we commit has a penalty, that there is a cost and a consequence of the things that we do. We hurt ourselves, we hurt people out in the world. Sin is costly in every single way. It doesn't matter how big or small that we kind of perceive that sin to be, that actually that sin has a consequence out in the world. It will hurt somebody or something at some point. That's the way that we understand sin itself, our wrongdoing itself. And actually, Paul recognizes that. We could go back to that famous verse in Romans 3 that teaches us about this, and this is something that Christians always use to bash people over the head. All for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Bash. Isn't that something we can easily think of in our head? Well, we know everybody's a sinner. That's just a way of saying, that's pointing the finger and saying, well, that person's a sinner. We don't often point the finger towards ourselves at that point, I find. But you know that my frustration is that we never complete the verse. And that actually the completion of that verse is perhaps the most important bit that you could remember, because the completion of the verse says that for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and are freely justified by the things that Jesus Christ has done on the cross. My paraphrase. That you've been justified. So what does it mean to be justified? Well, sin has its consequences. Our wrongdoing has its consequences out in the world. But this term of justification means that you have been freed from the penalty of that sin. That's part of it. But actually what it further means is that not only have you been freed from the penalty of your sin because of what Jesus Christ has done, but actually he has declared your record clean. That he has said that nothing of that sin can be held against you, that you are free in that glorious place of liberty, that nothing can condemn you from that sin because I've taken it away, and that God has that authority as judge over our life. So it's not only simply that we're free, that not only has a judge or that God as our judge has declared us free, but he's also said that it can't be carried forward, which in legal terms is the greatest freedom I think that you could know. If you like criminal dramas, I think you understand this. I like those kind of things where actually it's you, that somebody somewhere, that penalty, that strike on you is there somewhere, it's visible. But in this case, justification says not only are you free, but every bit of that penalty has been removed for your sake, that out of the grace of Jesus Christ, you have been free and set free in every single way. And that's the point where this freedom stuff at the beginning just jumps back in. It is for freedom that you have been set free. So you have been justified. Don't gloss over that word, particularly in Paul. It's so important that we read this and understand it. So we must hold on, therefore, to the freedom that we've been given with every fiber and with every bit of our integrity. We must pursue and preserve that freedom at every cost, even if others try and convince us otherwise. We must not default to the old way of doing things, because that in itself isn't freedom. It's not freedom. And Paul's passion at this point is what holds this church. He's just so passionate that this church do not enslave themselves again, that they do not walk backwards into that place, but they remain in that freedom. You can understand, I think, why Paul is so passionate at this point. But what I love then, what I love about this next little section is this wonderful little juxtaposition of words. Paul tells us what it means, what we should do, what we should express out of that freedom that we know in God. He says this: "You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love." It's about the response that we should have to the freedom that we now know we have in Christ. What should you do with it? Well, you should use it not to indulge the flesh. That actually freedom doesn't mean that you have permission to do whatever on earth you like, that you can just indulge yourself in every single way and therefore rely on that freedom and justification that Christ has given you. Paul says this a number of times in the letters because again, he understands the human condition. We know what it, in our heads, freedom can mean that we can go out into the world chaotically, and our human nature would still expect that we would receive, because we believe that we deserve something, don't we? Isn't that part of our human condition, that we believe that we deserve something? And yet there is a different reality here. Paul is saying that you do not use your freedom to go out into the world chaotically, but there's a different way that you're to do this, that actually you're given a responsibility, that there is a consequence, that there is an expectation of what you will do with that freedom. And he says, he puts it this way, that you're to serve one another humbly in love. But actually, there's a little secret here which makes it some of Paul's probably most provocative writings, because he chooses a particular word that is translated into the English as serve. There are lots of other words that he could have chosen that would mean that same very thing. But actually, the word that he chooses actually means that is probably better translated, but it's so provocative that they choose not to translate it this way, that we're to enslave ourselves to one another humbly in love. Now that becomes provocative at that point, doesn't it? That if Paul actually does mean that, and that's my reading and understanding of it from the things that I've been reading on your behalf, that if he does actually mean that we're to be enslaved to one another humbly in love, that ups the stakes, doesn't it? Paul has spent the whole of this section saying, make sure you know and understand that you're free. He gets to the end of chapter 4 and says, make sure that you know that you're born of the free woman and not the slave woman, and that you revel in that freedom. Be free, he says. Be free, be free, be free. And then he says, enslave yourself. It's brilliant. Because what he's saying is that there is a humility to your response to the people around you in love. That actually that there is such a priority for us to serve one another, that actually it's like you don't have a choice, because that's what it means to be in slavery, doesn't it? That you do not have a choice about how you respond to the world around you. And I think that's what Paul's getting at here. He's saying that there is an obvious connection that you need to make here as you go out into the world in the freedom that Christ has given you, and it's you serving one another out of love, that you actually feel that sense of obligation to one another. And it's the people that you like and love. I would expect that you would find it pretty easy to serve humbly in love the people in this room this morning. I hope that you don't find that too difficult. I think we're a nice bunch of people. If you're visiting this morning, I think we're a nice bunch of people. And I hope that you get a sense of our love for you and our gratitude that you are here this morning. But it not only means that construct of community, those people that we are connected with in all sorts of different ways. The difficult news is that it also means your enemy. The difficult news is it also means your enemy. It means the people that wind you up rotten. It means the people that you feel antagonized by. It means everybody that you just have a general distaste for. It means the person that you are just uncomfortable being in their presence with. It's people who do not conform to your standards of what it means to live and to love. And you know, and that's why the gospel of Jesus Christ is outrageous, because it means that very thing. That love and grace in itself is outrageous. And that we need to let our hearts be convicted of that as his church. And say it's out of that place of faith and love that we see the needs of everyone in the world. And that we're willing to enslave ourselves to the world around us. That it's not a choice that we make, but actually that we sense that obligation to love and to serve. And you know what? That's the greatest freedom. It's at that point where we begin to participate in God's plan for his creation. It's a love that goes beyond any boundaries and limits. Paul goes on to say, and we haven't time to explore it all fully, but he goes on to say that actually you're not on your own in that exploration of the world. That actually what it means is that when we do that, we're walking not on our own, but with the Holy Spirit, who's our advocate, who walks with us, who dwells in us, and that that in itself is the greatest gift that we could be given. You are not alone in your walk and the ambition to love one another. But most of all, friends, this morning, I pray that you will hear this word loud and true, that you can be free. That you can be free. And I pray this morning that you would receive that freedom by choosing to live for God and know that there is a love which will take you out into the world to serve it. And even in that place, you shall be free. Amen.